And I'm reminded each time I tell a story myself. And some of my grandchildren, of course, like their parents, they're old enough to go to bed and then demand a story, to hear a story. So, and sometimes one reads a story, that's easier, or sometimes you invent a story. And no matter what you invent, no matter how ludicrous it is that you invent, you start, there was a man, or whatever the first line is, and then you have the kid's attention. And then you realize the expectation is that it goes on and that it develops and that it makes sense. And what makes them fall asleep is the happy feeling that life makes sense. And if it's only in a story. So whatever story you're telling, you cannot disappoint that expectation that it's making sense. Yeah.
Giant of European cinema, Wim Wenders. We'll hear more from him in a special extended interview today on The Cinema Show. Also ahead.
And I suppose that's the joy of festivals, is then the artist themselves gets to explain what they were trying to do, and then it's up to sort of critics and audiences to work out if they achieved that aim.
Jason Solomons wraps up his trip to Venice for this year's 73rd Film Festival. And a little later.
To fully appreciate how, ultimately, The Big Durian is one of the most genuine essay films ever emerged from Southeast Asia.
The editor of Asian cinema magazine Nang reviews the 2003 Malaysian film The Big Durian. That's all to come on The Cinema Show right here on Monocle 24. There are three cities that are almost guaranteed to be on the calendar of just about every cinephile. Cannes, Berlin, and Venice. Hello and welcome to The Cinema Show. I'm Ben Rylan. The Venice Film Festival was first held way back in 1932, making it officially the world's oldest. Among the industry heavyweights at this year's 73rd event was the German filmmaker, three-time Oscar nominee Wim Wenders. Monocle contributor Jason Solomons spoke to the director in Venice. We'll hear that interview soon, but first, Jason joins me here in the studio. Jason, welcome back to London. So, Wim's new film has been shot in 3D, which is immediately quite curious because, of course, 3D has almost exclusively been something limited to mainstream Hollywood blockbusters. And, well, to be honest, I've only ever seen one film in 3D that I thoroughly enjoyed and which I think utilised the technology beyond it just being a gimmick on the marquee. And that was the recent remake of The Jungle Book.
There's Ang Lee's Life of Pi sort of did quite a nice job with it as well. And I suppose Avatar, the bits in 3D worked. The other bits that didn't need to be in 3D, I thought was useless. It hasn't really been used to any great artistic kind of endeavours, really. Although Wim Wenders did a wonderful documentary on Pina Bausch, the German choreographer and dancer, which was in 3D and was absolutely beautiful and really put you on the stage with the dancers and got all the movement. So he is trying to use this kind of immersive equipment, this immersive gift, and to then do a sort of stage play as he did with Les Beaux Jours d'Aranjuez, or Fond Memories of Aranjuez, it's been translated as, is a very talky two-hander theatrical piece. His camera roves around and we get to sort of feel the house that it's set in and the wind in the trees that he was trying to capture. So it is an immersive experience and it wants to sort of take you into a Garden of Eden. It's very interesting, a film like this playing in a big competition like Venice is so contrasted to, say, like the sci-fi picture Arrival or any Hollywood movie, that people kind of aren't ready to listen to a sort of Austrian playwright's version of the creation story. So it comes over differently. And I suppose that's the joy of festivals, is then the artist themselves gets to explain what they were trying to do, and then it's up to sort of critics and audiences to work out if they achieved that aim. But I thought that it was still very, very interesting. It's a sort of coming and going story of the woman's sexuality and the man, kind of slightly more historical facts about the time he went to Aranjuez, this palace in near Madrid. I thought it was rather fascinating. I was kind of hooked on the conversation, the to and fro of it. It was like being at a fringe theatre, and I haven't been in one of those for a long time.
So why do you think it didn't quite work then? Is that down to the film itself just not being quite constructed well enough? Or is it because it was maybe attempting to use this 3D technology with a story that just really didn't warrant that? That's one annoyance I've always found, is that 3D is so often just an afterthought. It's thrown in afterwards, and you just don't really gel with the 3D medium being utilised properly for the story. But we're always talking about films like Alice in Wonderland, you know, Tim Burton's version of that, where, you know, it's not really about the story, is it? It's about the spectacle of what's on the screen.
Yeah, I got a feeling that when there was a lot of piracy around, there was a sort of rumour that really the 3D was to sort of get rid of piracy, because you couldn't go in and take it on your mobile phone or your video camera. You couldn't, because it was all going to be in 3D. So it forced people to go for the whole glasses thing.
And they can charge a hell of a lot more for those tickets. Yeah.
It's not, 3D isn't narrative most of the time. So you think, well, I can see that movie in 2D. And sure enough, there are many 2D versions around. And you think, well, you know, that film's no better in 2D or worse in 3D or whatever it is. They're the same. So,
and half the time you can't even tell. Like if you're sitting there in the cinema and it's supposed to be in 3D, you take your glasses off for a minute and you think, it looks exactly the same. Why am I wearing these stupid glasses?
Exactly. Well, I did that with the Wim Wenders movie and took them off to see it, and it is completely a blur. You know, it's totally in 3D. But watching it, you were sort of strangely up close to it. You were sort of in it. I mean, I'm sure in 2D it would look all right as well. And the strangeness of it was that you just don't see movies like with just two people talking anymore. It really is the sort of stuff of theatre, whereas movies have a beginning and a middle and an end. This doesn't really have that. They don't really come together. They don't really do anything. They just converse for a long time in French. I mean, there are some subtitles, but, you know, and it's kind of quite theoretical what they're talking about, and it requires some big performances from the actress Sophie Simon and Khede Khateb, which they sort of do manage to deliver. But then there's the playwright. It kind of zooms out, and the playwright's sort of sitting in the house writing as he goes. So it's about sort of the process of creation and playing with your characters, and the playwright as kind of director or god in a way. And there's a lot of that element in there. I mean, it's because of the 3D, there's a sort of extra texture to the movie, and there's almost a sort of a meta texture to it as well. So I think it's a really intelligent kind of look at doing a two-hander like that. But maybe, you know, we're sort of inured to that, and we are sort of like thinking, oh, 3D, great, there's going to be, you know, Thor and Black Widow are going to turn up in a minute. They don't.
Spoiler. So, I mean, it is interesting to hear someone like Wim Wenders kind of trying to get across the benefits of 3D, because obviously most of the time when this is trying to be sold to us, it's coming from big studios or big cinema multiplexes. Did you get a sense, because I know you've spoken to him, and we'll hear him talk about this himself in a few moments, but did you get a sense for why he is such a fan of the 3D medium? Because, I mean, he really loves it, doesn't he?
He does. I mean, he's to the point where you think maybe he's sort of flogging a dead horse here. But I think he really committed to it a long time ago. But he's always committed to different technologies. I mean, Alice in the Cities he did back in the 70s on a very sort of light camera that was very, at the time, very sort of portable. It was almost like doing your holiday movie. Buena Vista Social Club was one of the first films that was shot on like digital video and those kind of little handheld cams that everyone had for a while. So he's always experimented with it. And yet he's also kind of, you know, a great film historian as well. And I think he really believes that 3D was going to bring out this new kind of dimension in a way. And even when people like Martin Scorsese tried it with the film Hugo, and he was trying to recreate those George Méliès moments, Scorsese got evangelical about it for one movie. But Wenders has kind of stuck to his guns here and really thinks that it could be used for artistic purposes. I mean, it's great for photography in a way. It would bring that to different life. But he's not quite managed to convince everyone else to join his crusade. And I think he's feeling that, you know, this is his last shot at it. And it hasn't really worked. People didn't go, oh, Vim, now theatre is a new thing we can see in 3D. This wasn't the movie that was going to convert anyone to 3D, which I think is a bit of a shame because he really thought it might. And I sort of felt a bit of a sadness about it.
Well, Jason Solomons did have a bit of a chat to Wim Wenders at the Venice International Film Festival. Let's have a listen.
The task of the film was to make people listen. It's not easy to listen to two people talking for so long, because it's even difficult for them to listen to each other, because the more they talk, the more each one realizes how different the other thinks. And after a while, it's not easy for the man to see how the woman thinks and to see how she answers to his questions by not answering but getting into other areas. He has very simple questions. How was it the first time? I mean, who was it? How old were you? Who was the man? Was there blood? And she's not interested in that. She doesn't even remember. Her memory of her sexuality is a different one. So they talk to each other, and each time you realize there's more and more of a gap. The gap is also there for the audience, because in the audience you're either a man in the audience or you're a woman in the audience. So you sympathize with the way of his thinking or the way of her thinking. So it was important that you listen. You're patient with each other. So I had to make a movie where you're patient and where you really get involved with the words. And in my book, in my feeling, 3D is an immersive medium, and it gets you to be closer to a person, and the person is more present in front of you, and because your eyes converge, because it needs your two eyes to see the film, and it needs your both halves of your brain to see the film, your eyes converge, and therefore you look in a different way at the person speaking. And it's more like you are the one who that person is speaking to. So 3D being more immersive and requiring different parts of your brain that movies never usually activate, I figured that 3D was the right medium for a film where the words are so important. And the other reason is that nature plays such an important part, and even for nature, I think there's cinematic experience has never invented a better tool than 3D to represent nature. It's unfortunately a great cultural disaster of our days that Hollywood has monopolized this technology and this language and this medium, and made everybody believe it's a medium that is only good for kids, that is only able to tell action and blockbuster movies. Because in my book, its best abilities are the contrary. Its best ability is that it can be so tender and so gentle, and it can guide your experience in a more intense way than ever before. Unfortunately, it's abused and misused in such a way that it'll also in the danger of disappearing soon, because people are sick and tired of it, because they think it's not a tool that you can use for any serious storytelling. And unfortunately, most of my colleagues believe it too, because the studios have really monopolized it. So I think I'm very proud that I made this film in 3D, because more than with my other ones, I proved that it can be tender and gentle. I don't know if it'll change anything. Unfortunately, as I said, 3D might be disappearing before we know it, and then it's going to be one of the great cultural crimes of the new century.
You've always been quite innovative, but do you wish you'd have had 3D when you were making Alice in the Cities, when you were making those films?
No, not at all. In that time, there was no other filmmaking than the one we used, and there was only film, and there was no digital language and no video and nothing else. I'm happy that nothing else existed at the time, and I would not want to convert any of these movies. But I'm also happy that I was able to live through this time, and that I was able to begin at the time when there was only film, and that eventually I was able to use video, and I used all forms of video, and eventually there was digital, and eventually there is 3D. And I actually worked with people who started their careers in the silent age. I worked with people who actually had made movies in the 20s. So I felt I was still in touch with the beginning, and I'm still not old enough to see some of the future. I have a beautiful projector at home, a great technology. I can see a very big screen at home. And because I'm a member of the American Academy, of the British Academy, of the French Academy, of the European Academy, of the German Academy, in the course of the year, I get 5 boxes of 100 films. So I have at my home every year like at least 500 movies, and some before they even come out in my country. So most of my theatrical experience is at home, where I must say I have a better projection than they had here in Venice.
Because you see so much cinema, as a member of five academies and still president of the European Film Academy, and you made a film here which is almost a traditional theatre piece, but you've made it experimental. Where do you see the future of cinema? Is it a positive future? You're talking about cultural disaster in 3D. Is it still a positive future? Is it still the medium that it was, cinema? You don't even go to the theatre so much anymore, but you still watch a lot of cinema. What is cinema now in the 21st century?
Cinema is still much needed, and there's a very basic human need to listen to stories, but listening is a little bit out of fashion. Watching stories is still a great need, and even if a lot of the watching of stories is happening now in front of very tiny screens, and most of the kids who see my films, even my students, most of my movies they have seen on their mobile phones. So I got over that, and I'm happy that at least they saw some of it, and that some of the film history, even if they see it on their computers, at least they have an idea of it. So the viewing experience have changed a lot, but the need for stories and the most popular way of storytelling has become cinema. The need for movies will remain even stronger, and if they are telling a story at all, every story by definition creates sense. Every story by definition leads somewhere and tries to make sense out of something, even if it's a senseless movie. And so I think that need is eternal, and ever since the time of the old storytellers who still had to tell stories verbally, and I met some of these cultures where there's only verbal storytelling, like the Aboriginals in Australia that I lived with for a while and that I got to know. I couldn't even show them the film I made with them. I made Till the End of the World and in some Aboriginal communities, and I couldn't even show them my film because they had no right to see a movie where somebody appears who is dead. So I could not show them the film, and that was a great disappointment to realize they can't watch it, although I made it for them in many ways, because some of their ancestors are still to be seen and they are not allowed to see somebody who's dead. So I know some verbal cultures, and I know the great value that story has for them, and story is more valuable for them than for us. Story is a necessity to survive. And in a strange way, I think movies are still not that dramatic, are a necessity for us to survive. And they will exist always, but they will change their shapes and there will be no more movie theaters. Maybe there, in another 20 years, we still have some cinematheques where they have screens, and otherwise they'll have disappeared and will be replaced by other things, and people will be able to see these visual stories in different ways. And who knows what it is, if it's virtual reality or whatever it is, but it will continue.
Can't tell whether you're sad about that or realistic about that or depressed about it.
I'm curious what it's going to become. And I've produced movies only made on mobile phones with my students, and it was amazing what they came up with. And I'm happy that I can use to make movies with real cameras, but it's not bad to have the restraint to make it just on a mobile phone. And so it's all possible, and I'm not nostalgic by nature. I like to look back sometimes and think what could be used today and what is the value of that thing, and can some of the value be translated? Yes, I have a dream to make a film in Africa about African music. I didn't get to do it. At one point, I was about ready to do it. Mali underwent a very, very difficult time, and musicians were killed, and instruments were burned. So that was a time when I was about to go there and make a film, so I couldn't anymore. And maybe I missed the boat because some of the musicians I wanted to film are no longer with us. So African music I listened a lot to. That was a dream. I think that music is something so subjective. And you don't do it alone, because I'm not a musician. I would need to find the musicians I want to do it with. I made this film with Mother Deus. Mm-hmm. And of course, it was not about them, and it was not about Father, but at least it reflects a lot about it, and it was a great experience to be working with them.
Do you have a message for British cinema after Brexit? You're president of the European Film Academy, and Britain has Brexited. What does that mean for British film?
I'm very sad about that thing, and even if all my English friends are considering applying for German citizenship.
We need them. Yeah, we need to be together. No, I think, you know.
Yes, it's such a step into the bloody past, and that bugs me so much. I'm so sad about all these young people whose future is being killed from, or being taken out of their hands. That enrages me the most. That all these old farts made a decision that only concerns young people. We still love all of English members in English cinema, because the European Film Academy doesn't make any difference between a political Europe and a cultural Europe. We have Israeli and Palestinian filmmakers in the European Film Academy. So for us, the Brits are just as welcome and as much friends as before.
German filmmaker Wim Wenders chatting to Monocle contributor Jason Solomons in Venice. After the break, the editor of Asian cinema magazine Nang brings us his pick for this week's Critics' Choice. You're listening to The Cinema Show. Stay with us.
Do you like good films? Well, you're in luck. The Cinema Show is presented in association with MUBI, the curated movie site of cult, classic and award-winning cinema. And we've got a special treat happening at the moment. Just for our loyal listeners, a whole month of movies for free. Head over to mubi.com/monocle. That's MUBI/monocle. Because life is too short for bad films.
You're back with The Cinema Show on Monocle 24. I'm Ben Rylan. Nang magazine is published twice a year and says its ambition is to build upon the rich and powerful history of Asian cinema. The magazine's editor is Davide Cazzaro, an Italian with such a deep affection for Asian movies that he now calls Seoul home. For this week's Critics' Choice, we asked Davide to choose a film that helped steer his passion for the craft of cinema. His pick? Well, the 2003 Malaysian docudrama, The Big Durian.
Malam 18 Oktober 1983, seorang Afra mengamuk dengan senapang M16.
On the night of 18 October 1987, a soldier ran amok with an M16 in the area of Chowkit, Kuala Lumpur. His name was Private Adam. Due to the thorny circumstances of the time and place, his amok triggered citywide panic.
These are the opening lines, voiced in Malay language by narrator and director Amin Mohammed, right after the credit sequence of a 2003 film entitled, in a purposely mysterious and playful fashion, The Big Durian. The film may appear as an erratic string of brief encounters and interviews interspersed with Amir Muhammad's own voiceover narration, as well as his appearances on camera as he revisits the actual Kuala Lumpur locations where the incident took place several years before. The views talk either about the rumors surrounding the incident or about how the period affected city life in general and the interviewees in particular. Let us hear from one of them.
In 1987, I was a tour guide, and I remember that day when I got a call from the tour operator. He told me that all the tours for that day were cancelled. And I said, what? And I asked him why, and he said, because there was some trouble in Chowkit. And I told him, what difference does that make? Because we don't go to Chowkit anyway. Our city tour just comprises of the National Monument, we just drive around the lake gardens and stuff like that. And then he told me, no, there's going to be trouble, and so he didn't want to take any chances in sending. In fact, all the hotels had advised their, their customers, their clients, that the tours were cancelled. So for that day, I didn't do any work. In fact, we didn't have work for 3 days after that.
These and other films by Amir Muhammad are never only about the quote-unquote story they seemingly set out to tell. And it takes perhaps a second viewing, something that can be easily done today given that the full film is legally available on YouTube, to fully appreciate how, ultimately, The Big Durian is one of the most genuine essay films ever emerged from Southeast Asia. Able as it is to slice through Malaysia's complex history and hot-button issues with a powerful mix of poignancy, wit and wry. For a start, the interviews are actually a combination of monologues performed by actors and testimony from ordinary people recounting the 1987 events, something aimed at mirroring the confusion and the mood of the time, when the real and the fake, rumors and official versions, secrecy and exposure were often juxtaposed to one another. This brief, almost mockumentary-style scene is exemplary in this regard. We hear stage actress Sandra Sodhi speaking in strong Malaysian English as she pretends to have no recollection of the incident and tries to run away from Amir Muhammad himself.
Sorry, I don't know anything. Sorry.
Do you remember the time, October 1987?
Sorry, I don't know anything. Don't know. Sorry.
Were you in KL at the time?
Huh?
Are you from KL? Are you in KL at the time?
I don't know anything. I don't know. Sorry.
Do you remember this man named Private Adam? He ran Mengamuk at the time.
Private Adam, Private Saddam. I don't know. Mengamuk all. I don't know.
Completed in 2003, more than 10 years before the current ongoing scandal that exposed yet again the abuse of power and the level of corruption and cronyism at the very top of the local political and business elite, the film maintains today its sense of urgency and, I would venture to say, its social responsibility. The Big Durian doesn't do durians, those spiky fruits with poignant smell, native from the region, but it does raise problems and ask questions, leaving viewers to wonder, when will Malaysia become anything else?
Davide Cazzaro, editor of Asian cinema magazine Nang. You can pick up a special preview edition of Nang now. Head over to nangmagazine.com. And that's it for today. The festival flavour continues next week with the Toronto International Film Festival. And as Bridget Jones lands back in cinemas yet again, we'll perform a health check on the romantic comedy genre. Today's show was edited by Claire Crofton and Kieran Matthew Banerjee. And of course, it was researched by Yolene Goffin. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast and leave us a review as well. The Cinema Show returns next week. I'm Ben Rylan. Thanks for listening.